You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, lighthouses haven't been the only thing guiding boats on the Great Lakes. Light ships also helped point the way for more than a century. We'll find out what they were like and where they were used. Now, House impeachment managers rested their prosecution of former President Trump yesterday. Today, senators heard from Trump's legal team. The trial, which began Tuesday of this week, has shifted into a question and answer section, and it's not expected to go on past the weekend. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been watching the trial unfold all week? What have been your impressions? Did you just tune in today? What's your reaction to what you saw? What do you want the outcome to be? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Susan Johnson is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get to this week's trial, the last time I think you were on with us was January 7th, the day after the insurrection at the Capitol. That's what led us here with this impeachment trial this week. Now that more than a month has gone by, I'm curious as to what's on your mind in the intervening month.
Yeah, it's interesting to reflect back on that conversation that we had that was just over a month ago in the immediate aftermath. And I think people were still dealing with just the shock of what had happened the day before. I think that what we've learned is, quite interesting and I think quite telling. Things that, I would point to is the fact that we didn't know at the time just how well planned the event had been, or the riot, I should say, the insurrection had been. We didn't know at the time that there was considerable planning that had gone on in different places, to get people all together, the extent to which members of the Trump campaign team were involved in some of the planning and organizing of at least the rally that led to the insurrection. Also, we had kind of an idea of what had happened in the Capitol, but over the past month and particularly over the past few days, we've seen quite a lot more footage from inside the Capitol that gave us, I would say for most of us, a kind of a chilling look at what was going on during those hours when the Capitol was breached. I would say also since then, we had the inauguration of President Biden. And former President Trump, because he's no longer on social media, has really, disappeared in a way. We haven't heard from him. And that's something that I don't think we would have expected to have been the case when he left office. And then just one more thing. I would say on the 7th and those few days after the event, there was a lot more outrage from Republicans, both elected Republicans and out in the electorate. And as we're vote counting in regard to what might happen with the vote to convict, we're seeing that a lot of people who expressed considerable outrage are likely going to vote to acquit the former president when they have the vote, likely, like you said, this weekend.
One of the main arguments from the president's defense team, in addition to saying that the vote itself, the impeachment trial itself, was unconstitutional because the president is out of office, they were contesting the idea that there's a straight line between the president's rhetoric and the events in the Capitol on January 6th. I want to give a listen to one of the former president's legal team, David Schoen.
Throughout the course of today, my colleagues and I will explain in some detail the simple fact that President Trump did not incite the horrific, terrible riots of January 6th. We'll demonstrate that to the contrary, the violence and looting goes against the law and order message he conveyed to every citizen of the United States throughout his presidency, including on January 6th.
And that's stacked up against the impeachment manager's case, saying that especially since the election, pointing toward the president inviting people to the rally weeks ahead of the event, spreading false claims about the outcome of the election. Talk about the clash of those two ideas. The president generated this event. The president didn't, his legal team says.
Well, remember, this is a trial. And so you had the prosecution, the House managers, who were laying out their case for why they believe that this charge of incitement was appropriate given the from the rhetoric that former President Trump was using. And you had his attorneys, on the other hand, pointing back to former President Trump's law and order message as being a bit of a defense. I think that if you look, however, at the language that former President Trump used at that rally to all of those people amassed there and spoke to going to the Capitol, now we are going to the Capitol, and using terms, you know, fight like hell, and I'm going to go there with you, and some of the other language that was used, I think that while both sides were clearly using information that was most beneficial to their campaign, I think that the House managers were honestly being more truthful in representing what happened on January 6th.
Talking to Susan Johnson, political scientist at UW-Whitewater, with the latest on the impeachment trial. Something that came up in the Q&A now, we had a couple of moderate Republican senators bring up the question, basically, what did the president know about when Vice President Pence might be in danger, when he was evacuated? They said he had no, the president had no idea that Pence was in danger. But we had Senator Tommy Tuberville, Republican from Alabama, saying he had talked on the president to the president on the phone, saying that the vice president had been evacuated, that the president was, reports that the president was watching TV as that happened. And after that, the president tweeting still an attack on Vice President Pence for not trying to overturn the election. How key a moment do you think that is, that the president may have understood that the vice president was being evacuated and not spoken up at that point?
Well, I think it's one of a series of key moments that the House managers pointed to and that the senators who are the jurors should be considering quite strongly. And yes, as you said, Tommy Tuberville, who is a strong supporter of President Trump, so, you know, not someone who you would expect to not support the president, indicated that he was on the phone with the president and said that he needed to go and that Vice President Pence had just been evacuated. And we heard report after report of the president watching this on television. So I think it's an important point. And I think that for those senators to have been asking that question, I think is telling, because perhaps in their mind, it might make a difference to them.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Scott is with us in Iron River. Scott, hi.
Yes, hi. Nice to be on with you both. One question that's been really burning at me, actually, for the last 4 years, and it's come to a head now with the whole insurrection, the trial and stuff, is you never hear the Democrats saying, kind of like as we're all trying to work through this and come to some terms, you know, let's work together and stuff. But, you know, if the tide was turned, if it were a Democrat doing and saying the same things, let alone an African-American president or a woman that happened to have last name Clinton, if those people would have been doing or saying the same thing, and especially standing in front of a crowd of, say, Black Lives Matter protesters, saying the exact same words and having the exact same outcome at the Capitol, how come, why don't we hear Democrats using that? And I know, you know, from a legal standpoint, you probably cannot, but I, you know, learned yesterday on your program that this is not a legal trial. It's more of a political trial. And I would think you would hear Democrats using that. So I'm really interested in your answer.
Thanks for the call, Scott. I mean, I think over the years, Democrats have said, yeah, if one of us was saying what Trump said, I mean, I think people said if any other candidate, period, was saying what Donald Trump was saying, people might react differently. I don't know. What do you think, Susan?
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure what Scott was asking, but I think that absolutely, I think that it's not Democrat or Republican. It's Trump and a whole lot of everybody else, as you're indicating. And there have been people who have been forced to resign from political office, have not won re-election for office or election for office, for saying a lot less than what former President Trump has been able to say. And so I think that that's where I'll leave it.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Jim in Brookfield now. Jim, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I think the media, you know, is really at fault for a lot of things, because they showed all summer long, you could see cops getting water thrown on them and everything else happening. Al Sharpton saying, you know, fry them like pigs or fry them like bacon, talking about cops. And now you've got this, and it's kind of like, what you're seeing here is the same kind of violence, and you can't. And I think your guest said something about all the pre-planning that went into this, and the riot that ensued as a result of the rally. Well, wait, the pre-planning came in before the rally, and then all of a sudden it's a result of the rally.
I got you, Jim. Thanks for the call. So first of all, Susan, an equivalency, Jim's saying, between the Black Lives Matter protests and the violence and arson and looting and things like that and the Capitol. And that's something we've heard from Republicans as well. What do you make of that argument?
Right. And so what we're focusing on right now is the impeachment trial of former President Trump with the charge of incitement. And so we're speaking, you know, directly about what he did or may not have done to lead to the insurrection that took place after the rally. And so when we look at issues related to some of the protests that took place this summer, and you're right, people are making a lot of, what about that? And I would say that there's a couple of ways to approach it. The protests that took place in the summer that were sometimes accompanied by violence, the protests themselves were for a social justice movement in response to systemic racism and police brutality and things like that. And there was a separation between a lot of the violence that took place and the protesting. But I also would say that when making these comparisons, if that was unacceptable, then so was this unacceptable. You know, so maybe thinking about it that way.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Susan Johnson from UW-Whitewater about this week's impeachment trial of former President Trump. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What have you taken away from watching or listening to the impeachment trial over the course of the week? What do you want to come out of it? What do you think it all means for future politics? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater, looking at the latest on the impeachment trial. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. We'll go back to your calls now. Todd is with us in Janesville. Todd, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Todd?
I was just wondering, I know their defense or Trump's defense is freedom of speech and his lawyers or whatever. But I was wondering why that is allowed when he is the leader of this country and he speaks for this country, and his speech should not be considered freedom of speech. He's actually speaking terms or beliefs or whatever you way you want to put it for this country. I cannot fathom why the Republicans or anybody, Democrat, independents, cannot see that what he did was a breach of his oath.
Todd, thanks a lot for the call. And that's an argument, Susan, we've seen from the House impeachment managers. The president talking isn't just an American citizen talking. This is someone who's taken an oath of office as president. Is that a significant distinction to make?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point to bring up, in that we're not just talking about an individual's First Amendment rights. We're speaking about the spokesperson, let's say, for the United States, and what higher threshold there might be or what higher expectations there would be. I think that when the his attorneys are making the free speech case, they're making the free speech case more akin to what we would consider, you know, yelling fire in a crowded theater and things like that. What you can't do in terms of incitement. And I just want to say one thing in regard to incitement and my comment earlier about the planning for this at the event. The House managers looked back over the course of the buildup to the election and the statements and comments that President Trump made about the election being stolen. And then throughout the campaign, and then after the election was over and he lost, that led to the rally on the 6th that then led to the insurrection. So it's not just language that he spoke on that day, but things that he said throughout the course of the campaign that I think are all wrapped up into that idea of incitement.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Joe now in Sheboygan. Joe, hello.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for having me on.
What did you want to bring up, Joe?
Well, what I want to bring up is that, you know, today's Republican Party is not your father's Republican Party. It seems to me like they're leaning so far to the right that they've always become radicalized, and this has become Trump's party. How that happened, I have no idea, because now we're looking at a cult personality almost like. You know, the way that Hitler came about, and even Mussolini, we can almost compare it to the way that this man, Trump, carries himself. You know, he is looked at like some kind of god from these Republicans that went down to the Capitol after he incited them for months. You know, you cannot, it's indicative of the Republicans try to bring up Black Lives Matter movement. You cannot compare it, you know, and then trying to say that it was Antifa with a fake flag going in as Trump supporters to take over the Capitol. We're talking about incitement going in and trying to take over democracy. Our democracy is very fragile. You know,
I'm going to jump in. You gave us a lot to talk about, Joe. First of all, Joe's suggestion about Trump's role in the Republican Party, Trump, in effect, being the Republican Party. Susan, a lot of people in the Republican Party are trying to figure out how to navigate that. We saw Nikki Haley, formerly in the administration, in new remarks, kind of distancing herself, a likely presidential candidate there. How do you see Republicans balancing Republican Party versus Trump's Republican Party?
What we're seeing is really interesting in that, you know, Nikki Haley is a great example in that piece that just came out today, and different things she said over different points of time when that those interviews were taking place. She's someone who's eyeing perhaps a 2024 run for president, and others are doing the same thing. And they're trying to make a calculation as to how impactful will former President Trump be on that. And quite frankly, is he going to run himself in 2024? And so we see a small number of Republicans who voted for impeachment in the House and a small number in the Senate who voted to keep the process moving forward. But for the most part, we're seeing the majority of Republicans in the Senate and the House aligning themselves with former President Trump. And so I think the caller is correct that most people would agree that at least right now, former President Trump represents the Republican Party. And it's just a matter of figuring out how long that exists. And will the other Republicans, the more moderate Republicans, let's say, or the institutionalist Republicans, if they're able to regain control of the party?
And Joe also suggested that the events of this month point toward the fragility of American democracy. And I've talked to an expert on kind of strongman politics who studied Mussolini a lot, raising the same questions. I don't know. Do you, Susan, feel like maybe our institutions are more fragile than we might have thought a year ago or 5 years ago?
Yeah, I think honestly, if you would have probably asked me that even at the end of 2020, you know, I think what happened on January 6th really shook a lot of people to the core. The idea that the Capitol had been breached for the first time since the War of 1812, that you had people, you know, calling out to hang the vice president and setting up gallows right there and looking for the speaker of the House and all of the violence that we saw. I mean, I think that for a lot of us, it was a reminder that perhaps the the democracy is more fragile than we had thought.
In our last minute, Susan, it seems likely from many Republican senators' comments that the president will not ultimately be convicted here. That said, do you think there's a value in having the arguments laid out from both sides and recapping the events of January 6th, that there is a value here to have gone through this exercise for the American people?
Well, I think there's a value because there were very legitimate questions that were put forward that now people are being asked to go on record and indicate whether or not they in fact believe that what President Trump did over the course of, you know, several months was incitement to the insurrection. I think also it provided a lot for people to take in and see as far as what happened that day and then, you know, make a decision about whether or not that's acceptable.
We'll leave it there. Susan, thanks for joining us again today.
Happy to be with you.
Susan Johnson is Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. We talked with her about this week's impeachment trial, the second one of former President Donald Trump, including the defense attorneys from Trump making their case today. You can follow live events there at WPR.org. That's WPR.org. As things are happening there, you can listen live. Coming up, we'll learn about the history of lightships, which helped guide sailors along the coast of Wisconsin and around the Great Lakes, and those places where you just couldn't put a lighthouse back in the day before GPS. Remember, you can keep Wisconsin Public Radio with you pretty much all the time. You can listen on a radio, a car radio, but also at the WPR app on your smartphone. If you got one of them smart speakers at home, you can figure out how to bring the Ideas Network up there. Just tell it to do it. It works on a lot of them. And you can listen on your computer at WPR.org. You can live stream Ideas Network programs and check out our archives, too. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, seniors are at the top of the list for COVID-19 vaccines, but there have been some obstacles when it comes to online registration. We'll find out about the problem and how providers are trying to overcome it. Now, it's well known that the Great Lakes could be a dangerous place for boats during the heyday of maritime shipping and that lighthouses were an important part of keeping sailors safe. But what about light ships? For more than 100 years, lightships acted as mobile beacons along the Wisconsin coastline. Our next guests are here to share some of that history. Ken and Barb Wardius are lighthouse historians based in Glendale. They're the authors of several books, including Wisconsin Lighthouses, A Photographic and Historic Guide. Barb and Ken, welcome back to Central Time.
You're welcome, Rob. Nice to be here.
Thank you. Great to
be here. Let's first paint a picture. What struck me about what you wrote about this, Barb, is life on one of these light boats in, say, the late 1800s or so. A few dudes on a boat for months at a time. What was this like?
Can you imagine? Sure, the boats weren't that big. There was a lot to do, but, of course, the government wanted to keep things inexpensive, just a few people to keep the light lit, keep the foghorn going, and there you are on a boat with somebody that maybe you don't like so much. It was not fun. The pay was bad, but they were regular, dependable jobs.
And Ken, talk a little bit about the evolution of the Great Lakes lightship and how we ended up needing these guys.
Okay, you know, as most people know, if you know much about maritime history, mariners relied primarily on lighthouses. They date back on the Great Lakes to the mid-1800s. There were certain locations, especially very shallow areas, rocky outcroppings, and other things in the water that you could not see, and you couldn't erect a lighthouse there because the technology at that time just did not allow them to put things in the water. So the lightship, the idea, it's a very simple idea. A floating lighthouse, something that can be towed or moved out to an area that a traditional lighthouse couldn't be erected. Later on that change, we can talk about that a little bit later. But primarily, these were areas that would not lend themselves to the typical brick and mortar lighthouse. The evolution of the lightship itself dates back to the Roman times, actually, but on the Great Lakes, early to mid-1800s. So they were just built in response to commerce, like lighthouses were, but they were in very specialized areas that needed that type of beacon that a traditional lighthouse could not function as.
Well, Barb, a lighthouse isn't a lighthouse without the light. Same with a light ship. Could you talk about, you know, what they were lighting up in the 1800s and how it changed till the end of the lightship era?
Oh, sure. Originally, the lights, the mariners complained they were weak, they were inadequate. They had a series of wicks and oil that they tried to light. Eventually, they had some kind of lens to put over it to avoid that thing being blown out. And eventually, they redid a lot of the masts so they weren't so heavy, the light wasn't so top-heavy. And they actually implemented on some of the lightships the French-made Fresnel lenses, which really revolutionized lighthouses, that they could see the beam that much further on the lake.
And Ken, we had a couple of these in Lake Michigan off of Wisconsin. It looks like one of the longest running you write about was by Peshtigo. Tell us a little bit of that history.
Yeah, Milwaukee actually had a lightship as well, but the two main ones were the Peshtigo Reef lightship and the Milwaukee Harbor lightship. Peshtigo Reef dates to 1912. It's in a very, I mentioned before, some of the shallows and some of the rocky areas that you couldn't traditionally build a regular lighthouse. But that lighthouse is off of the city of Peshtigo, north of Green Bay. It's in the Bay of Green Bay. It's a very shallow area. You see the Green Bay and you think it's deep, it's easily navigable. Off of the city of Peshtigo, some of the waters go out about 3 to 4 miles, and it's only a foot or two deep. So the government decided that would have been an excellent place to put a lightship. At that time, they could not erect a lighthouse. They eventually did later on. But for about 30 years, the Peshtigo Reef lightship, it was called number 77, mariners used that seasonally, early spring through late fall, to guide them around what was called Peshtigo Point, that shallow area of the bay.
And that brings up an interesting point, Barb. You two wrote that there were some seasonal problems. Some of the places you want to bring your lightship, you can't because the ice is still there, like maybe right now, I imagine.
Like right now, that was one of the reasons. You know, thankfully, technology moved ahead that they could actually erect a crib lighthouse on some of these offshore locations. But a lot of the things that we've read and researched indicated that it was a problem to get them on station early on, maybe March or April, because of the ice. And the same thing getting them off the ice at the end of the season, that they were fearful many times that the ice would crush the ship. And, of course, the people on board could die. So they were very lucky once technology moved along and they could actually erect crib lighthouses and do something more permanent rather than a lightship.
All right, Ken, you told us about the Peshtigo lightship. How about the Milwaukee one you mentioned?
When we were doing our research on all of the lighthouses of Wisconsin, we found out, and we've dug into a lot of the nautical and maritime history of Milwaukee. We had no idea that there was a lightship stationed about 3 miles east of the harbor. Milwaukee, historically, like many Great Lakes ports, had pier lights. Eventually, it had a breakwater light. But in addition to that, beginning in 1912, the Milwaukee lightship number 95 was anchored a few miles offshore. In addition, there was a lighthouse on the north part of Milwaukee Bay called North Point Lighthouse. There was also a pier light. It's in the Summerfest area of the lakefront now. But that light in the harbor really was not that bright enough. Most of the pier lights close to town, you could see them for 7, 8, maybe 10 miles. So the government decided they would put a light ship farther east in the harbor, and that guided mariners for over 20 years.
Barb, as you mentioned, the light ship era ended with developing technology. Most of these ships, it sounds like we can't see anymore. There is one, though, in Port Huron, Michigan, or as my grandpa called it, Port Yorn. There at least is one of these ships left that's a museum.
It's awesome, yes. They've totally refurbished it. It's been updated. They have docents on board. So it's in Port Huron. It's right on the St. Clair River. And during the season when it's open, you can actually get on board the ship and talk to the docents, and they will tell you what life was like. And this ship happens to be one of the larger ones, but even still, to be stationed somewhere 2 to 4 months on this boat would have been really, really challenging. But if you ever have the chance or somebody's really interested in maritime history, you need to go to Port Huron, definitely.
We'll leave it there. Barb and Ken, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Welcome. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Rob.
Ken and Barb Wardius are lighthouse historians living in Glendale. They're the authors of several books, including Wisconsin Lighthouses, a photographic and historic guide. They talked to us today about the history of light ships, which were in use for over a century on the Great Lakes. Coming up, not everyone has what's needed to quickly snag a vaccine appointment when their turn comes around. We'll talk to a reporter about how internet access is a barrier for some people, even when they are eligible to get a vaccination. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Many states and local governments have offered websites and apps as the primary means to register for COVID-19 vaccine appointments. While convenient to some, this has proven to be an obstacle for people who don't have internet access or people who aren't regular internet users. That includes the nearly 30% of people in the U.S. over the age of 65 who don't use the internet, according to Pew Research. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Has the internet or technology been a factor in making it difficult for you or a loved one to register for a vaccine appointment? Let us know about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Rebecca Highwell is a reporter at Recode by Vox.com, where she reported on this issue. Rebecca, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we have this rollout of vaccines. Of course, the internet is being used as a way to help people register and sign up. What kind of ways are we seeing technology being used to get vaccine appointments right now?
Right. So we have this really big problem where there's a limited amount of supply of vaccine. A lot of people really want it. Right now, only a certain number of people are eligible for it. So the way a lot of localities and states are organizing this is through websites, apps, online schedulers that work with email addresses to basically give everyone a slot and tell them when to sign up. So it's very tech heavy. They have these centralized databases that deal with open appointments at all sorts of places in your locality that make sure you get the slot that you're assigned.
Well, perfect if people have good internet access and know how to use it. You talk to some people, though, who are not in that category. What kind of personal stories did you hear from people?
I heard a range of stories from people who work with a lot of seniors who are struggling to actually access these appointments. So some of the struggles are pretty simple. There's someone who maybe went to the library to get their internet as a senior, but the library's closed or isn't really safe to go to because of the pandemic, and now they can't get a slot on the internet. There are other people who just don't have internet access at home or have a limited amount of internet and aren't able to access the appointment. And then there are people who simply aren't comfortable using the internet to do something like scheduling a kind of sensitive medical appointment.
Right. You wrote that some people are worried about being online and sharing a lot of personal health information with the internet.
Right. So if you've been told for the past 10 years, don't put all your personal information online, and now you're on an official website telling you that you should put your name and address in order to get this vaccine, it might be kind of confusing and you might be kind of cautious.
Have you seen states or local governments or health providers trying to work to bridge that gap and have non-online ways that are accessible for people?
Definitely. One of the main solutions that some localities and states have turned to is phone lines, but even those have some sort of barriers to them. If you're someone that doesn't speak English, it's not necessarily guaranteed that there's going to be someone who speaks the language that you speak available on those phones. Also, the wait times can be really long and potentially really discouraging to a senior There are also challenges of there just not being enough people on these lines to actually take the call. So that has been the main solution. But there are other kind of innovative options that people have turned to as well. So in New York, in one area in New York, they're actually sending, you know, health officials with tablets to seniors' homes and registering them at their homes.
Now, part of the problem here is, and we know this in Wisconsin, not everyone has really solid internet access. How big, forget knowing how to go online and do these things or trusting putting your information out there, how big an obstacle is just this sheer lack of access?
For older people, it's a big problem. You know, I think you mentioned this earlier, but Pew gave out this number last year that more than 40% of people over 65 don't have broadband access at home. So it's a huge challenge. And we have to remember that's also compounded with other aspects of the digital divide. So rural communities, some city communities don't necessarily have great internet access. There's also a racial digital divide that we have to keep aware of as well. So these issues really compound each other and can make the problem a lot worse in terms of actually having the internet to register for one of these appointments.
Talking to Rebecca Highwell, reporter at Recode by Vox.com. She has reported on the issue of online registration for COVID-19 vaccines. Seniors in general are eligible for those vaccines, but may not have access to the internet or comfort for one reason or another going online and registering for their appointment. And it's making trouble for some people. As they want to get that vaccine, can't necessarily figure out how to get it. You could share your story of yourself or a loved one, difficult or otherwise. Was it easy to get an appointment or tough? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Rebecca, you also talk about a side problem here. The fact that people can't necessarily successfully get online and register is also leaving people vulnerable to scams. What are you seeing?
Yeah. So another challenge is that if you're someone who's not so online, you might get someone calling you saying, hey, if you give me your credit card information or your social security number, I can get you early access to the vaccine. I can get everything set up with you related to the vaccine. So there are phone scams that certainly might target seniors. And then there's another problem where people are setting up fake online vaccination sites. So it might look like the site you're supposed to go to, but if you're not paying close enough attention, you might be giving your personal information to a scammer instead of the public health department or the vaccine provider that you're trying to work with.
Did you run into suggestions on how to make sure you are on the right kind of site?
Well, I think the most important thing is that you should look at the actual domain or URL. So that's the address that you see on top of any website you're at. And then try to Google it and try to actually find it through your locality or state's public health website and kind of reverse engineer it, if that makes sense. Even though the domain might sound legitimate, you really have to double check that it's actually the right one, because the scammers can be pretty creative. Another thing to keep in mind is that if someone's calling you and trying to pressure you to give up your information, and it feels kind of suspicious, don't be pressured. Take the extra moment. No one should be pressuring you to give up a lot of personal information, financial information on the phone in order to get the vaccine. And of course, always check websites like the FTC's website to look out for resources to guide you through sort of protecting yourself from scammers.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Ellen is with us in Milwaukee. Ellen, hi.
Hi. I spent a couple months trying to figure out where I wanted to go. I asked my rheumatologist, and she said, oh, I can't help you because you have to go to your primary doctor to get a vaccination. So I went over to my primary, who then they said, well, I put my name down, but they can't give me anything special. I'm over 65, and I do have an autoimmune condition, it is not a disease, in my lungs. So I really am, you know, very vulnerable. So the primary happened to be at Aurora, and Aurora told me that I would maybe have to wait a while because they have 600,000 patients who are over 65. So I'm in that line somewhere. So I tried to go to the Walgreens, but they have no facility or ability to sign you up and put you in the system, and there's no waiting line, you know, put together. So I then heard from my nephew, who's a PA, said, go to Myers. That's a grocery store. I said, I don't know if I want to go to a grocery store. It's M-E-I-J-E-R-S. I walked in. They handed me a clipboard with a form on it, said, fill this out. You will be on the next list when we get the vaccine again. We're next week doing the second shots for the people we did 2 weeks ago. It was clever. It was smart. It was quick. And it was so, so enormously satisfying.
Well, I'm glad. Glad you got a happy ending there, Ellen. And Rebecca, Ellen points to there's some good news here in that more grocery stores, pharmacies, there are going to be community vaccination clinics starting up in Wisconsin. There are getting to be more options than just sign up on the internet as vaccine supply starts to pick up. Is that a promising sign for the future?
I think that's a really promising sign, and I'm so glad you were able to make some progress there in your own journey to getting vaccinated. I think, you know, what it also shows is that part of the challenge here is simply knowing, right? Is simply knowing that it's going to be at this location or this location, and this provider is doing it one way and this provider is doing it another way. So, you know, on the other hand, if you have internet access, it's often easier to actually get that extra information and learn that extra step over this new place, about a new place, for instance, that might actually have access to the vaccine. But increasing supply will certainly ameliorate some of this problem.
Thanks a lot for that call and sharing your story. We'll go to John and Baronet. John, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to tell us about, John?
Well, what you guys were talking about is exactly the frustration that I'm going through. I'm 71 years old. I'll be 72 pretty soon. I've had the COVID thing once and got sicker than a dog with it. And I called Marshfield Clinic, where I do all my healthcare stuff. And all I got was talking to a machine. And they called me back 2 weeks later and left a message on my phone saying that they'll call me when they have a space, but it might be a month. And I keep seeing on TV, well, if you're over 65, you can get this thing. You know, that it just seems ridiculous. And now I see on the news that people, you know, other people are starting to become eligible for it. But I haven't seen any sign of anywhere that I can go to get this vaccine from.
John, thanks a lot for the call. And Rebecca, this is going to be a common story, or it has been. I think people are in eligible categories, but that doesn't mean there's enough vaccine yet coming from the companies to the federal government to the states to the local vaccination centers to vaccinate everybody in that category soon. Is that what you're seeing around the country?
Yeah, it seems like there's just, you know, there's a lot of communication problems. Also, I think the message is not getting out to the people who are, you know, we're eligible first as they need to receive it, even as we're expanding the eligibility. So I think, you know, a lot of governments, a lot of, you know, local officials have to be working a lot harder to make sure that those people have access to that information and know where to go. It's not right that people have to be running in circles to get access to this vaccine if they are eligible for it.
Thanks for calling in, John, and good luck to you. Rebecca, what are you watching for now as people are, you know, at the state, local levels and elsewhere trying to figure this out? What are you watching for next?
I'm looking out for the Johnson & Johnson application to the FDA. I think that could be a real game changer in terms of supply and just entirely change the dynamic of this. For one thing, I believe it's a single shot, which means that the logistics requirements are going to be much lower. And it also means it's going to be a lot easier to vaccinate everyone, including seniors. So I think that's something I'm keeping my eye on really, really intensely.
Rebecca, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Rebecca Highwell is a reporter at Recode by Vox.com. She wrote the piece, A Big Hurdle for Older Americans Trying to Get Vaccinated Using the Internet. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Monday at 7:30, a state lawmaker joins the show with a plan to change the way that Wisconsin awards its electoral votes in presidential elections. That's Monday at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll hear about a new federal package of bills aimed at helping address racial disparities in maternal health care. We'll hear from a Wisconsin Democratic member of Congress and then an expert on the issue. And by the way, on today's edition of Food Friday, Cajun and Creole cooking, we've got some recipes online from our Food Friday guest, Ace Champion of Green Bay. Some great stuff, an awesome sounding bread pudding dessert with an amazing sauce, plus a crab dip and pita chips, and a pot roast entree. You can find them all and start cooking right now or make that grocery trip. WPR.org/Food Friday is the place to go. That's WPR.org/Food Friday. Hazard of the job, I'm hungry. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.